That was close. Almost forgot the recording. I was about to jump into things and move on. Monday morning, October 25th, 9 a.m. And we were just discussing, because we just had that big storm that rolled through. I said that if anybody needs any extra time due to power outages and things from yesterday, for the exam, I'm okay if that exam comes in a day or two late. You don't even have to ask me. Just take whatever time you need to get that thing finished. And today we're going to go on with the third reaction of the multi-step. So we'll finish that up. And I'm actually back home right now, which is kind of exciting. I've been back home for this weekend, although the storm took a little bit of my wind out of my sails yesterday. But that's given me an opportunity to catch up a little bit and try to catch up with the rest of my stuff that I'm supposed to be doing. Okay. Screen share. iPhone by cable should come up, and it did. And we are in business. Okay. Just because I've moved all of my equipment around again, sound, everything's working all right. You guys can hear me okay. Seems like it was all good. Let me know if there's any problems moving forward. We're going to look at the third step in the multi-step. And we're making benzylic acid. So those reactions, just to remind everybody kind of where we start with benzaldehyde. Benzaldehyde is reacted with thiamine hydrochloride. And we do this in sodium hydroxide. And we made benzoin. So benzaldehyde to benzoin. Benzoin is further reacted in an oxidation reaction with nitric acid to make benzyl. That was the last reaction we covered. And then benzyl is finally going to be reacted under a base catalyzed conditions using potassium hydroxide, and we make benzylic acid. So this is an isomerization reaction. And this is what we're going to focus on today. And this reaction, the reaction is fairly simple, but the workup is a little bit more complicated compared to the other reactions that we've done so far. So this one is benzylic acid, and that's our focus today. So that's our third step. This is a base catalyzed oxidation and isomerization. So the mechanism. Let's do that first, and then we'll go over the reaction. The mechanism's not too bad. When we look at benzyl as a carbonyl compound,
Benzyl has the two carbonyls which serve as nucleophilic sites. We react this with a strong concentration of potassium hydroxide. So the main component, the main nucleophile, is hydroxide ion. And hydroxide ion is reacting with the fact that what we have is a partial positive and partial minus in the carbonyl, in that dipole moment at the carbonyl. And so it attacks that carbonyl, breaking the bond and shifting the electrons up onto the oxygen. We've seen this now a whole bunch of times where a carbonyl opens up like this when a nucleophile attacks it. And we've shown it in a number of different types of reactions. And most of the time, when something goes through a tetrahedral intermediate like this, the reaction pattern that we frequently see is that the carbonyl tries to reform. It closes back up with ejection of a leaving group. And so that pattern persists in this isomerization. And what winds up happening is the carbonyl pushes back in to reform the sp2 hybridized carbon, and it ejects out a leaving group. Now there's only three possible leaving groups. I have the hydroxide that just came in, I have the carbonyl over here, and I have the aromatic ring over here. There are no good leaving groups in this molecule. But despite the lack of good leaving groups, the reaction does proceed, and it is the aromatic ring that gets kicked out. It migrates in like a sort of a 1-2 alkyl shift. It migrates over to the adjacent carbonyl. That bond breaks, and those electrons shift up onto that oxygen. So when that occurs, we've now got the reformed carbonyl we've got the redrawing things a little bit in a slightly different style. We've got the O minus that is sitting there. And now what we have is a problem in that I've got a couple of different functional groups here which are not compatible. So on the one hand, I have an alkoxide ion. And that is strong base. And on the other hand, what I've got over here, this component, is a carboxylic acid. And that equals strong acid. So the two groups are incompatible. And usually what happens is a solvent-assisted process where the proton is taken by one molecule and shifted to the alkoxide ion. And so it's usually solvent-assisted, but if we do it solvent-assisted, it shows up as having multiple ions present at the same time. It's easier if we just think about this, it's not quite accurate, but it's easier if we think about this alkoxide just taking that proton and giving the electrons back to this guy. We could draw it in an orientation where we could see that it would look fairly clean to do it within the same molecule. Regardless of how it happens, whether it's solvent assisted or it happens intermolecularly, the proton is transferred from the acidic functional group to the basic functional group. And we end up with an intermediate that we actually isolate. The counterion for this is the potassium ion. The potassium ion was floating around from over here with the hydroxide because we use potassium hydroxide. And so this is called potassium benzylate. And we isolate this as an intermediate. We then go on and we purify that. There's a purification step that we actually go through and do, but we just acidify this in that purification step to then isolate the benzylic acid. So the reaction really isn't that complicated. But it usually winds up taking 2 days to go through and do the process because you've got the first reaction, you've got the isolation, and then you've got a purification step that needs to happen. So that's the overall mechanism. Let's look at the reaction. Let's look at how we put this together. Unless there's any questions in terms of mechanism or how that functions or why that happens. Put the chat back up too. I can't see that yet. Okay, so reaction wise. We're going to add about a tenth of a gram of benzyl into a 3 mL conical vial and add a spin vane and a condenser. We don't really need the air condenser, but the air condenser helps to hang on to this thing when we actually go through and do the reaction. Notice too that if we go back and we look at how much of the benzaldehyde we used almost a gram of benzaldehyde in the first chemical reaction. And then in the subsequent chemical reaction, we used about 3/10 of a gram. Now we're only using 1/10 of a gram. The reactions keep getting smaller as we're going forward. Partly that's because we don't have as much product to work with. Every time you do this chemical reaction or one of these chemical reactions, we lose a significant amount of product. And so by the time you're done with this, you're going to have less than 1/10 of a gram of benzylic acid that you're going to isolate out of this thing. You're going to have very small amounts to work with when this reaction is done. And so your technique needs to keep getting better and better as you're going forward to try to get as high a yield as you can on each one of these reactions. Okay, we add about, let's make sure here, we say add 1/10 of a gram, but weigh benzyl accurately. Because your percent yield is going to be based off the mass of the benzyl that you use. And so you want to make sure that you get an accurate weight on that. We're going to add approximately 3/10 of a mil of 95% ethanol. And we're going to heat this at about 100 degrees C until dissolved. So when I say heat, the whole setup is one where we have the 5 mL conical vial. You've got your reaction components inside of this, along with a spin vane. You've got the cap that sits on this and the air condenser. So the air condenser is just a straight tube that, that fits onto this. This thing is then set inside a sand bath that we create with a little aluminum foil bowl. We make it using a beaker and just cast the aluminum foil around the beaker, folding it around it in order to make a squat little bowl. And then we pull it off the bottom of that beaker. And then we pile sand in here up to about the height of the liquid that's inside the tube. We also add a thermometer that comes down into the sand, and we like that thermometer to sit kind of low in the sand, not really touching the bottom, but sort of equivalent to where the reaction is sitting inside that sand. That whole thing then sits on a hot plate. So we're heating this thing up. And that sits on a jack stand.
So then you do attach the whole setup to some kind of clamp as well. Otherwise, you don't need a jack stand, do you?
We have a ring stand that fits back here, and we clamp both on the thermometer and we clamp on the air condenser. And that holds it all in place. So that's kind of our whole setup.
So in this case, why don't you just stick it in the sand and leave it on without the jack stand? It's like, just have it hang in there. It's not stable enough.
Whenever we do reactions, what you want is you want to be able to remove the heat without moving the reaction. You want the reaction to be able to be steady and stable, and you want to be able to bring the heat up and down. So what this does is this allows you to raise or lower the heat apparatus, and it disconnects it from the reaction. So if the reaction should get too hot, if you turn down the heat, it may take 15 minutes for the heat to drop to respond because you're heating through a sand bath. So you have all the thermal inertia that is in the sand bath. If you need to drop that heat quickly, let's say the reaction, while you're not looking, gets up to 150 degrees and you need to make an immediate change, then you can drop the sand bath and the reaction will stay hanging in the air attached to the ring stand. And you have thermally disconnected it from the heat source and it cools instantly.
And I suppose it's easier than grabbing a burning kind of like reaction vessel and moving it somewhere else.
Well, most of the time too, it's not that the reaction vessel is burning, but it's not like cooking, right? So when you think about cooking, you do think about food that is burning. But when you think about chemicals, we don't think about the chemicals burning as much as we do think about them literally catching fire and exploding. Or getting so hot that they erupt out of the container. They bump or boil ferociously such that they expel the contents out of the flask. So when you need to make an immediate change, you need to make it in the safest way possible. You never want to be moving a hot container or a container that could catch fire or explode. And so the most safe thing to do there is to thermally disconnect it, drop the heat, and have the thing cool down as fast as possible. It's just, you know, we're so attuned to cooking that we think about the way that we would cook when we move the pot away from the heat and the thing is, the emergency is over. But with chemicals, it doesn't quite work that way. And unless you're working in the lab and you experience those accidents from trying to move things. Every time I have tried to move a reaction rather than just letting it chill or dropping the heat, it has always been disastrous. I have always been met with explosions every time I've done it. Every time. Most famously, I had a reaction in grad school that I was making that was a dye molecule with a very large polyethylene glycol component. I was trying to make a soluble dye. So I was trying to make a dye that looked like a polymer but behaved like a soluble molecule. And I was putting 5,700 molecular weight polyethylene glycol chains onto this dye molecule. I was adding three of them. So my entire dye had a molecular weight of over 15,000 grams per mole. And as I was doing the reaction, I needed to move that dye from methylene chloride into water in order to isolate it. And as I was doing that, I was heating it in a SEP funnel. And I noticed that the methylene chloride started to boil in the SEP funnel, which freaked me out because there's water sitting on top of the methylene chloride. So you got to envision this. I'll erase this in a minute, but this is just for the purposes of the story. I had a SEP funnel. The SEP funnel was closed. It's sitting in a fume hood. So there's a cap that's on it. And inside this SEP funnel, down here is methylene chloride. Methylene chloride is carcinogenic. And up here, there was water. And I was trying to move my dye molecule from one phase to the other phase, and I was heating it with a heat gun. So I was using like a glorified hairdryer paint stripper, and I was heating this thing. And as I was heating it, I noticed that this started to boil, that the methylene chloride in the bottom started to boil. It has a boiling point of about 35, 37 degrees Celsius. So I had overheated it because it started to boil. The minute it overheated and started to boil, I realized that there was a problem because I had the water sitting on top of this. So it had gotten way over 37 degrees. It was boiling despite the pressure of the water that was pushing on it. And I started to panic because I had somewhere in the neighborhood of $6,000 to $8,000 worth of material in the SEP funnel. And so rather than just stopping to heat it and walking away from it, I decided that I needed to relieve the pressure so that if I relieved the pressure, I thought that the system would cool down easier and it would give the vapor someplace to go. I was worried that too much pressure was going to be created in here because of the boiling. And so I wanted to relieve the pressure and I wanted to pull this. But PVE equals NRT tells us that when we pull the stopper and we relieve the pressure, that when the pressure goes down, the boiling point also goes down. So that when I pulled the stopper, it exploded. And $6,000 worth of dye material, green fluorescent dye material, blew up all inside my hood. Took 2 weeks to clean up in order to get all the dye out of my hood. And I lost $6,000 worth of material because I freaked out and didn't think about what I was doing and pulled the stopper instead of stopping to think what had actually occurred and what I needed to do. So panicking and making a quick decision is never a good thing in chemistry. We always want to think through what could happen ahead of time, and we want to put controls like a jack stand in place so that we have those controls. And we know what to do when an emergency starts to happen, that we react with forethought rather than in a panic.
So would you still do it this way, or would you make sure you can measure the temperature off the liquid there?
I think that I would do it this way. I would not have the stopper in it while I was heating it.
Ah.
So it's the stopper that messed me up, because the stopper allowed more pressure to build up, allowed me to overheat it. If the stopper wasn't there and it started to boil, it never would have exploded, because pressure never could have built up, and then there never would have been a release of pressure, a sudden release of pressure. So it's those types of controls and thought that you need to put into an experiment before you ever actually do the experiment.
Couldn't you have just removed the heat source, like removed the heat from it and then allowed it to cool down, potentially blew it with some cold air to change it back?
Yeah, the best thing would have been just to walk away from it and okay. just let it cool down over time. Or instead of cool air, you could use a sponge with ice water, and you could, you know, gently go on the outside with a sponge with ice water, because it wasn't heated to the point where glass might crack if I tried to cool it down. It was heated just above room temperature. You know, 37 degrees is not all that hot.
Right.
And so all I needed to do really was walk away from it. I would have saved myself 2 weeks worth of anguish and $6,000 worth of doing this reaction over again. Mm-hmm. But life lessons. So craziness.
Is there a collection of stories like this? I figure this is very instructive.
It is. I mean, you learn, you know, it's important to try to communicate how important it is to think through a chemical reaction, particularly one that you've never done before, and to put controls in place for each foreseeable accident that could happen. Most of the time, you know, particularly when we work with really, really dangerous materials, we want to make sure that we have all of the safety things that we need, which are our personal safety things, but then we also want safety for the reaction. And so when you have a reagent that is extremely hazardous to work with, you need to know how to destroy that reagent safely. And you need to have what I call a quench solution that allows you to be able to dispose of it in a safe manner and in a controlled manner should an accident happen. For instance, tertiary butyl lithium is pyrophoric, explodes in air. And when you use it with needles and you transfer it via syringe. And at the tip of the syringe is always a little bit of fire that kicks out the tip of the syringe as you're moving this thing around. Well, what happens if the needle breaks? What do you do if the needle breaks and you can't then dispose of it into the container that you're supposed to? You need to have controls in place to be able to handle it should an accident go wrong. The famous story from grad school that our guys used to tell all the time was when the needle broke, the grad student at that time looked around to try to figure out what to do, didn't have the quench solution, saw the open window, and that's where it went. Went out the open window. not the best way to deal with things. But that's why you've got to think through all those possible accidents that could happen and how you can safely handle and control all the materials that you're working with. All right, next step here. We're going to, after we heat this up, get it dissolved and make it homogeneous, we're going to add in 0.25 mils of an 8-molar potassium hydroxide solution. That's an aqueous KOH solution, but fairly concentrated. And we do that dropwise through the condenser. So we just take a pipette and we drop drops of that KOH down in through the chemical reaction until that 0.25 mils are added. We boil the reaction. At approximately 100 degrees, 115 degrees, with stirring for 15 minutes. The reaction turns a deep, dark black purple. and it becomes rather opaque. At this point, after 15 minutes, we stop and we cool the reaction to room temperature. Okay, at this point, we start our workup phase. So let's look and see what that is going to look like. For the workup, we're going to transfer the contents of the reaction to a 10 milliliter beaker. We start working with pretty small glassware here because the volumes that we're working with are really, really tiny. So literally, this beaker is just a small 10 milliliter beaker. And you're just transferring the contents of that 5 mil conical vial into a 10 mil beaker. We're going to ice bath that for 15 minutes to induce crystallization, and scratching may be needed in order to get it to crystallize. So we may need a scratching rod. In order to get it to actually crystallize. Now, once it crystallizes, we're going to filter this on a Hirsch funnel. So remember that what was in here. What's in the beaker is 95% ethanol, and our compound that we're isolating, which at this point we have not acidified it. So at this point, it's the potassium benzylate that we're isolating. So this is a salt. When we filter this on Hirsch funnel, we don't want to rinse this with water because that salt is going to be highly water soluble and we're trying to collect that salt. So we want to be sure that we rinse this with 95% ethanol, not water. Filter on Hirsch funnel and rinse with, I think it's 3 times 1 mil, 95% ethanol at 0 degrees C. So we want that ethanol cold. This is a mistake that a lot of people make right here, is they rinse it with water. And as soon as they rinse it with water, they're starting over. Because when you rinse it with water, you rinse it into the 95% ethanol that already went through, you mix it with water, the whole thing becomes homogeneous and you lose the product, and isolating that product back out of the water and ethanol is extremely difficult. So what's happening here is the Hirsch funnel has a filter plate in it. This thing sits inside a Erlenmeyer flask that has a sidearm on it. This thing is hooked up to a vacuum and a trap. And a vacuum source. This guy gets clamped in place. Usually we throw a clamp around here, and your reaction is going in here, and your solid that you're interested in that is sort of blue, black in color. Yeah, I could be able to see that. Let's do it this way. We're catching that solid potassium benzoate. Which is sitting on the filter paper. And what's coming down inside the flask, this is 95% ethanol, and this is waste. So your product is being captured on the filter paper as a solid, and we want to be sure that we don't run that through with water, otherwise you lose everything. It'll just dissolve it. So once we get that solid, we usually dry the solid and weigh the solid. We always like to take a mass on a solid. Whenever we get a solid in any step, we always want to dry it. We always want to weigh it so that we can track the mass and look at the mass balance of where things are going. It tells us that if an error happens in a reaction, we can go back and we can look at our different weighings and we can track back and see where we lost mass. And it allows us to tell what steps need to be improved or what steps may have gone wrong in the overall procedure. Okay, so now we transfer the solid to a small 10 milliliter Erlenmeyer flask. And add 3 milliliters of hot DI water. We stir to dissolve it. Now what we need to do is a series of checks. There's a potential here where we may have to do an additional step. So we check to see that the solution is homogeneous. If the solution's not homogeneous, then what that means is that there are impurities that are in this that need to be removed. So if we think about what's happening here, that when we look at the Erlenmeyer flask, we've got potassium benzoate, which is dissolving in this. Potassium benzoate should be totally water soluble. So this is hot water. And the potassium benzoate as an organic salt, as a carboxylate, should be highly soluble in that water. So if we look and we see solids that are down here, any solid is not potassium benzoate. And needs to be removed. So the way that we move it, if there are solids in there, so if solids present, we filter them out on a Hirsch funnel using C light. Usually the solids are too small in order to be removed just by a piece of filter paper. So what we do is we create a C-Lite filter on top of filter paper, and then we filter through that. So the way that this works, the way that it looks, is we take that Hirsch filter, and it has the piece of paper that fits in there. This thing sits inside an Erlenmeyer with the sidearm. And what we do is we put the paper in there. So I don't know what color I'm going to use for the paper. Maybe I'll use this color here for the paper. So we put the filter paper in there. And then in addition to that, we create a slurry of C-Lite in water. So C-Lite is a diatomaceous earth product. It is like talc. It feels like talc. It's sort of dark gray in color to light gray in color. And we put 0.5 gram of C-Lite. And we add in about 3 mils of water. That goes into here, and then we mix that up, and then that gets poured onto this. So if we imagine this as a sort of grayish material, that grayish material sits on top of here and makes a layer on top of this, and that becomes the C-Lite filter. Once we get that C-Lite filter in place, then we take that and we pour our product through it. So now what we do is we take our small beaker or I guess it was an Erlenmeyer flask, really. And there's little dissolved solids that are in here. And we pour that material through, and those little dissolved solids get caught on the filter. And what goes through here, this is the water and our product. So unlike most filtrations, most of the time when we do a filtration, we're after the solid. This time we're not after the solid, this time we are after the liquid. So we need to be really cognizant of what it is that we're after here. So these guys are in here. The product is in the filtrate, not in the solid. So this whole part up here is waste. And the product is down here. Now we only need to do that if the solution isn't homogeneous, if we see dissolved solids. If we don't see dissolved solids, we just go on with the next step and we skip this. But if we have dissolved solids, then we need to get rid of them before the next step. So now after this, the next step here is to acidify solution with 0.5 milliliters of 1 molar HCl. Take pH down to 2. The idea here is that when you're adding HCl, the pKa on most carboxylic acids is about 4.5. In order to protonate them sufficiently to have them precipitate out, you need to take the pH down to about 2 pH units below the pKa. So what we're doing is we're adding an HCl, but this is a reversible equilibrium that's being created here. And it's not until we push the pH hard enough that we actually protonate everything. So the pKa of this carboxylic acid is about 4.5. We go to a pH of 2. That's approximately 2 units below the pKa. That makes sure that in this equilibrium, what we're doing is we're chasing the equilibrium so it exists far to the right-hand side, to the protonated side, as opposed to the non-protonated side. If you took the pH down only to 4.5, you'd have 50-50 of the molecules on each side. So you need to get several units below that pKa in order to cause it all to precipitate. At this point, what precipitates is the benzylic acid. So then we ice this for 15 minutes, filter on Hirsch, and then rinse with maybe 2 times 1 mil of water this time, because now it's no longer soluble in water. We dry it, and then we go for our characterization. We want to get a mass. We want to get a melting point. And we want to get an IR. And that's the overall reaction. All right, so let's see. We're coming up right on 10 o'clock. Let's take a break here. Let's do the separation scheme and the characterization of what we expect to see FTIR-wise and that stuff. Let's do that after the break. So let's take a 5-minute break here, and I'll see you guys back at 10 o'clock straight up. All right, sounds good.
Thanks.
Yeah.
You should see me in a crowd. I'm gonna run it. something to how. Watch me make them bow. One by one by one. One by one by. You should see me in a crowd. Your silence is my favorite sound.
That was just too much. I could not take that for this morning. I had to change the music. Going for a little California honey drops here.
that. I really don't like it when you do that. So why do you do it when you know I don't like it? And you know you shouldn't do it, so don't do that. I really don't like it when you do that. You know I don't like it when you do that. So why do you do it when you know I don't like it? And you know you shouldn't do it, so don't do that. But
all right, coming back. Ah, this is such a luxury to be at home because I get my standing desk. That means I could stand up while teaching. I don't have to sit down the entire time. So much easier. All right, let's look at the separation scheme. That was the one thing that, well, there's a whole lot of things. When switching to teaching at home and teaching remotely, one of the things that I had the hardest time to get used to was just not being active all day. When I teach, I never sit down. I'm always moving when teaching. It doesn't matter if I'm teaching in front of a class or I'm teaching in a lab, I'm constantly moving, I'm constantly walking. And I went from a constant movement sort of routine to like trying to sit in front of Zoom all day. It was just wretched. Okay. Oh, I'm not screen sharing, am I? Let's get the screen share going. Okay. There we go. Separation scheme. All right. Separation scheme always starts when you take the reaction and start separating out the components. It's at the first point of separation. The first time where you take and you stop adding things and start the workup and start trying to get things out of the chemical reaction. So for us, that's that first filtration step where we get the solid that precipitates out. So, and when we do a separation scheme, we want to put in starting materials. Products. And possible side products. If you can think of what the side products might be, or if you know what they are, we put in this possible side products and we throw everything in together. So our starting material was the benzoin or benzyl. I'm sorry, we're making benzoic acid. So this is the benzyl. In this first step, we make the potassium benzylate. So it's the potassium benzylate that we're isolating in the first step. And then other things that may be in the solution are the KOH that we started with. There's a little bit of water that was in there. There's some ethanol. So that's everything that goes into the first reaction. And at the point where we start to separate it out is the point where we do filtration. So this is the first filtration step. And then we break it down by phase. So we're going to get a solid and a liquid. In the liquid, we get all of those things which are in the ethanol and the water and that are soluble in there. So we get the ethanol, we get the water, the KOH goes that direction, and anything that's ethanol soluble, which is the benzyl, which is water soluble, ethanol soluble. And over on the solid, the only thing that's not soluble in the ethanol water mixture is the potassium benzylate. Now I say the only thing,
it may not be the only thing. There may be some impurities that are in this that we need to possibly filter out in another step. So let's add in here that there are also some impurities and that we don't know what the nature of them are, but we can add them, that they may have shown up there in that original reaction as well. And so this step is the optional step. If those impurities are there, this is the part where we talk about doing the C-Lite filter, and that the C-Lite filter will get out those impurities. And that happens at the point where we add water. So we take and we add water into this. And the solid potassium benzoate should dissolve. So we should get aqueous. Actually, we should say liquid, since we're doing it by phase. And I'll put here aqueous and then solid. The solid is the impurities. And this filtration, this represents the filtration step that could be here. If needed. And that aqueous is the potassium benzoate. In the next step, what we do is we take and we add the 1 molar HCl to that. The 1 molar HCl creates two phases again. We get a solid and a liquid. That 1 molar HCl is aqueous, so we have added in water and HCl. In the solid, we're precipitating out the solid benzylic acid. And that's the whole thing. So the separation scheme really isn't too bad. I guess the other thing that I'm missing here is we get HCl and the potassium salt. We end up with potassium chloride that ends up over there as well. So that's one other part of tracking where that potassium goes. And this now is the benzoic acid. All right, let's take a look at a couple of the physical properties in the characterization of what we're expecting. Let's talk melting point for a minute. Expectations. We started off with benzyl. Benzyl had a melting point that was 95 degrees Celsius. What about benzylic acid? Do we expect that to be higher or lower? What do we expect for benzylic acid? It's the same molecular weight. Well, no, it's not. I guess it's got one more oxygen in it, so it's a little bit heavier.
Should be a higher.
Yeah. What you've got is you've got the carboxylic acid functional group and you've got the hydroxyl group. So all of these have H bonding capabilities. And what you had over here was dipole-dipole. So we are expecting significantly higher, and it is. It's 150 degrees Celsius in terms of the melting point that we're expecting there. So that's considerably higher. Also, carboxylic acids are not only higher because of their H bonding, they're higher because they also do this. They tend to create what's called a dimer. They dimerize. And that dimer, it's an H-bonding dimer. That dimerization almost doubles the molecular weight and causes the melting point to be much higher for carboxylic acids than it is for most other things. So even if we were to take out the alcohol and we were to compare an alcohol to carboxylic acids, we would see that carboxylic acids tend to have much higher melting points than alcohols. Number one, because the hydrogen bonding is more extensive. Number two, because this dimerization process that they tend to link together and join together in a very strong hydrogen bond. So that's part of it as well. Okay, and then FTIR wise. When we look at the FTIR for the first compound, we had the carbonyl group that we are looking at. And so what we get is we get some carbon hydrogen stretches. And then we get a fairly sharp 1700 peak. And then we go into the fingerprint region, which that's not my best fingerprint region. I'm gonna try that again. Oftentimes that dips out like that. So this is the CH stretch and the carbonyl at 1700 reciprocal centimeters. So the main thing that we were looking for before was that these carbonyl groups here show up here. And if I remember correctly, this one even had a little split tip on it. I'm not going to draw it in there. I'm just going to leave it the way it is. But it had a bit of a split tip on the end of it for that 1700. When we look at the other molecule, what functional groups are we looking at now? And what are we expecting the IR to look like?
Maybe a broad peak at the beginning for the alcohol?
Yep, definitely. So it's a combination of a number of different types of peaks. When we look at the alcohol, if we take the alcohol as the first part, alcohols typically have that broad, smooth 3,500 reciprocal centimeters. So that's the alcohol. What about the carboxylic acid? What does it show up as? It's got the carbonyl, so the carbonyl shows up at the 1700. So we get a strong 1700 reciprocal centimeters. That's part of it. But what does that carboxylic acid, the OH, show up as? Do you recall? Typically, it shows up in the alcohol region around the 3500, but it has a different shape to it.
It's more jagged.
Rather than being smooth, it tends to be jagged in nature. And so this piece here is what we're looking at here as being the jagged part. And the carbonyl shows up over at the 1700. So this is 3500.
So we wouldn't actually see the smooth broad peak. It would be that broad peak, but jagged.
Yes and no. The other thing that happens is that this guy, when H bonding, shows up as this smooth peak. When it's non-H bonding, it shows up in the 3500 range as being sharp. And that's non-H bonding. Can't fit it all in there. I'm trying to cram stuff in there on the side that doesn't belong in there on the side. Let's just say non-H bonding. And so this one actually, I believe, we'll go get it. We'll go look at it and see what it looks like. I believe it has the sharp peak that is adjacent to it. It winds up looking like this, which we might not actually expect. So what happens with this one, I believe, is that we get the carboxylic acid in the jaggedness here, and we get the 1700 for the carbonyl. And I think this is somewhere around minus 3600 that winds up showing sharp as the hydroxyl. Is non-hydrogen bonding hydroxyl group. And I think that that's what winds up happening with this molecule. But let's go get it and let's actually take a look at it. So I'll remind you, let me stop this screen share. And let me screen share a new window over here. I can never remember the initial, so this is the way that I find it all the time. Spectral database for organic compounds. So this is SDBS. And what we can do is we can pull up both the benzyl . So there's benzyl and there's our IR. And what I'm going to do is grab just the image and bring this over. And then let's go get the benzylic acid too. Always making sure that we're looking at the KBR disc as opposed to other types of IR. So you just got to look real quick and make sure you know what you're grabbing. Let's return to search and let's look for benzylic acid. There's the IR. Check and make sure that we're on KBR disk.
which I believe we are. We'll grab this one. And I'll bring that over to. Okay, let's switch back to the iPad. And now, come on, mouse, you can do it. It's my mouse freaking out and not wanting to work. Okay, there's the first IR in the product. And you can see that split tip. And what we're looking at is the two carbonyls. They're showing up at 1668, 1662. It's not that there's really two different carbonyls and so I'm getting two different peaks. It's just the way the peak is manifesting. So there's that carbonyl peak and where they show up for that guy. And then in the other, and just out here, all we're seeing out here is carbon hydrogen stretch. And then let's bring in the next one. Okay, and with this one, like I said, we don't often see this, but with this one we do. The hydroxyl group is showing up here as a non-hydrogen bonding hydroxyl group. It doesn't usually show or present this way, but when we do this in KBR and it's not in solution and we disrupt the hydrogen bonding, sometimes when you disrupt the hydrogen bonding, you get a hydroxyl group that presents as a sharp peak. So this is the alcohol, non-hydrogen bonding. And that peak is showing up at 3,400. Then we get the carboxylic acid, which has two components to it. So the carboxylic acid has this component, which is showing up more jagged. So this whole thing we think of sort of as the carboxylic acid. Although what does happen with the carboxylic acid is right here. These are the CH stretch coming through the carboxylic acid. And this guy here. Is the OH component of that. And then additionally, we have the carbonyl, and the carbonyl is showing up here. And that's showing up at 1720. And so that 1720 represents a shift from the 1668, 1662. So if we were at 1668, 1662, and we went to 1720, that meant that the carbonyl that was here this was 1662, 1668, this is now 1720, that it has moved and migrated from what was the ketone now into a carboxylic acid. And so the wavelengths, the frequencies actually migrate and move. So it's not as if we just still have a carbonyl, the carbonyl is at a new wavelength. And that's an important change in that as well. All right, what else is in this? Probably this guy here.
this is probably at, I want to say 1200, let's see, 6420, 1248. This is probably 1248 and represents a carbon oxygen single bond. That's one of the things that doesn't show up when we come back over here. We won't have that 1248. We have a 1246, but it's really tiny. There's a 1212, and I don't know what the 1212 corresponds to, but normally what we do is we usually get, when we have a carbon oxygen single bond, a sigma bond like that, we will frequently get something close to 1200, which is a deep sort of broad peak. So we can put this one sort of like with a question mark. The other ones are solid. The other ones are really distinctive for this compound. All right, does that help in terms of knowing what you're looking at? And then everything else, usually what we say is that everything else out here is just fingerprint, that we don't try to correspond all of those different bonds to specific functional groups. We just sort of use it as a fingerprint component to compare to the spectrum that we take. All right. Okay, that's the last reaction. So two things that need to happen now. I need to get you all of the videos so you guys can watch all the videos. And then we also need to have a conversation about what this formal is going to look like. So we'll give you guys some time to watch all those videos, collect all the data, and then we'll have a day or two where we talk about this formal report and how this formal report is different, because you've got three different reactions that need to go into this formal report. So it's sort of like three formal reports all in one, only because you're combining it into one, it's less work than doing three total. But you have to think about how you want to handle the data and how you want to handle the discussions and what needs to happen in the discussion components and how you need to discuss each chemical reaction that is done and the outcome of each one of those chemical reactions. So we'll have that discussion pretty quick. And I'm going to see if I can't get the rest of those videos up for you guys to go through and watch those. Okay. All right. I think that's it for today for this. Let's take a little bit longer break. We'll come back at 11:15 and we'll do lecture. Okay.
Cool. Thanks.
All right. You're welcome. I'll see you guys back at 11:15.
Okay. So do you think we'll be having that conversation on Wednesday or next week?
I think that I want to get the videos up and have you guys watch the videos before we have that conversation about the formal report. So I think I'm going to try and push that conversation until next week, and we'll see if I can't get the videos up for you guys to watch for this week.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
All right, you're welcome.